Welcome to another in our series of Kehillat Israel podcasts. This is a recording of Rabbi Amy Bernstein's weekly Friday morning Torah study.
Good morning. Good morning. It's great to be with you this Pesach. We are at Chol HaMoed Pesach, the Shabbat on a part of Passover that is not Yontif. Yontif has its own readings. And so the Shabbat of Pesach, if it's not Yontif, if it's Chol HaMoed, has its own readings. So we are reading the Torah reading for Chol HaMoed Pesach, the Shabbat of Pesach, which Robin Close reminded me. Also, we read the Song of Songs. So the text that we read that's not from Torah, we often have Haftarah and other things that we read. Ashkenazi Jews read Song of Songs on this Shabbat. It is erotica. Song of Songs is erotica. And
what's wrong with them?
Linda Scheibel says, what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. It's interesting that it's in the canon. It's interesting that it's in the Bible. Rabbi Akiva argued stridently for it to be in the canon. Most of the rabbis argued against erotica being in the canon. But once you reconstruct it as being an allegory of the love between God and Israel, it makes it into the canon. But it is, without a doubt, fairly graphic erotica. His fruit hangs over my face. People, it just does not get like clearer than this. So Robin, I wish I had a lot to say about Song of Songs. We're going to not do Song of Songs today, maybe next year. Maybe Robin can send me some commentaries and we'll do that next year, but she didn't get to me in time. So instead, we're going to go down a different rabbit hole. So Don, Robin's husband, sent me an article this week about using language from our Torah portion. And I'd already, before the women's Passover event, watched a lecture on Hadar, which is a great website for watching Jewish content. I heard a lecture on Hadar, children of believers, something about children of believers. And the rabbi who gave this lecture, a woman rabbi, it's a modern Orthodox institution. So her name is Rav Avi. So, of course, I thought it was a man when I saw the source sheet that it was going to be some guy. Fine, that's fine. But it turns out to be a woman. So Rav Avi gave this lecture on a verse that we're going to look at, that Robin's husband sent me this article that also quoted this verse. And whenever that happens, I'm about to prepare a Torah study for y'all. I'm like, okay, this is like a big sign from the interventionist God that I don't believe in, that I'm supposed to do something with this for y'all. Now that we've left the triennial and my security and my guardrails of knowing exactly what text I'm supposed to learn, it's like, okay, so that's where we're going this morning. We're going to go there and see where it takes us. It is about the Exodus, not to worry. I'm not going to stray too far, but we're going to go some interesting places. Okay. So we're going to look at this part of our story that also Rav Avi Strasberg, when she was teaching about it, she also brought this story because of the times we're in, because of celebrating this Pesach at a particularly difficult and for many of us, frightening time. I'm teaching this as my daughter is trying to figure out how to get into the library on campus because there's a big tent village there. I'm not going to call it pro-Palestinian because we are all pro-Palestinian. I hate it when people say they're pro-life and that means they are anti-choice. So I'm not going to use that language. It's an encampment, right, that is protesting against Israel and against Jews in general. So they blocked off the entrance to the library. The school blocked off the entrance to the library and she has to figure out how to go all the way around and through another building and come through. And she's just like, I can't believe this, Mom. She's not freaked out at all. I believe partially that's because she knows she has over 900 families at her back. I really believe that. I believe she's not intimidated because she's used to hanging out here. You know, so this is all in her heart and mind as she confronts. And she goes, Mom, none of them have any idea what they're talking about. Like they don't even know. Like if you ask them, they don't know anything. She goes, look, if I know, I don't know enough to argue with anybody. She goes, I know I don't know enough. It's very complicated. And I know I don't know enough to argue with anybody, but I'm also not out there, you know, like with an opinion based on something I know nothing about. So she's mostly annoyed. But for a lot of kids, they are very triggered by this. And in lots of places and in other places, it's a lot worse. So a lot of people at the same time, this Pesach, were teaching from a place of, this is not our normal, yay, we're out of Egypt. Yay, we're coming out of the narrow places. Where do we feel stuck? What are we going to unstick this year? Where's our leavening? Where's our chametz this year? Like, it's just not that kind of Pesach. It's been a Pesach where we're still really wrestling with what it means to hear chariots behind you. All right. So that's kind of the context in which everybody is studying and writing and reading. And so we're going to do that too. We are at Exodus 13. By the way, the assigned reading for this Shabbat, since I'm not doing it, is the liturgical calendar. So we're going to get to it lots because it's every holiday. So we'll get there. And it's also, you know, my favorite scene with Moses and God on the mountain. I love that scene. But we're going a different direction. So Exodus 13.
What page?
That was I like to read about 371.
Thank you.
What do you want people to know what the truths are?
It's, you know, you're asking for kids who are really cut off from the area and the region to understand the intricacies of that region. Adult Jews don't know. Adult Jews don't know. Adult Jews can't hold their own in an argument or a discussion about this. Why do we expect our kids would know? And I'm not trying to be smart. I'm not feeling defensive. I swear. I know it sounds like that. I'm frustrated that none of us knows enough because we don't make it a priority to understand the intricacies of what's happening, right? We're happy with sound bites. We're happy with, you know, Am Yisrael Chai. And I'm not saying we shouldn't say Am Yisrael. I'm just saying that we don't spend a lot of time and energy on anything of any sophistication or complication anymore. We all are happy to swallow sound bites and move on to our morning. And so it's frustrating that none of, you know, there isn't an understanding of the complexities of, you know, of the situation. And therefore, there are things you can't say, right? Because there's just so much black and white and right and wrong and us and them and whatever, whatever. You can't even say certain things that you want to say because you do understand the complexities of the situation, right? If I say anything about innocent Gazans, you know what happens to me? But, right? Like, so it's, you know, it's just, it's a very frustrating and complicated situation.
And the kids had a perspective to ask questions.
It's really hard.
People don't know how to talk to each other anymore.
Mm-mm. And they don't, and a lot of them don't know how to think, which is a little bit about what we're going to talk about. All right. By Dibar Adonai Moshe Elei Mor, something new and different. God is speaking to Moshe. Kadesh lichol bechor peter kol rechem bivnei Yisrael be'adam uva behema lihu. So consecrate to me every male firstborn, human and beast. The first issue of every womb among the Israelites is mine. Of course, later, the tribe of Levi is going to stand in for the firstborn, right? The tribe of Levi becomes the consecrated folk and stands in place of the chor. And Moshe says to the people, Zachor et hayom hazeh. So remember this day on which you went out from Egypt, the house of bondage, how Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh freed you from it with a mighty hand. No leavened bread shall be eaten. You go free on this day in the month of Aviv. So when Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which was sworn to your ancestors to be given you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you shall observe in this month the following practice. 7 days, which is what Reconstruction is for, by the way. We do 7 days of Pesach. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a festival, Chag, right, to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Chag HaMatzot, this is an ancient, probably agrarian festival. It's wedded to what? What goes with it? Chag Ha. So this is Chag HaMatzot, 7-day grain festival, gets put together with Chag HaPesach, the offering of the Paschal Lamb. That's how we get an 8-day festival. Chag HaMatzot, we are in the Chag HaMatzot. Throughout the 7 days, unleavened bread shall be eaten. No leavened bread, chametz, right, shall be found with you. And no leaven shall be found in all your territory. Hence the prohibition on even owning chametz, which the rabbis took seriously. Like, you can't even have any at all. V'higadata levincha bayom hahu limor. And you shall explain to your child on that day, it is because of what Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh did for me when I went free from Egypt. And this shall serve you as a sign on your hand and as a reminder on your forehead, in order that the teaching of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh may be in your mouth, that with a mighty hand, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh freed you from Egypt. Okay, now, for me, this is proof that sign upon your hand and a reminder between your eyes is metaphoric. It is not tefillin. Otherwise, we'd be tying matzah on our hand and strapping it to our forehead, right? It is obviously a metaphor. This is a sign, you know, on your hand and between your eyes. It is obviously metaphorical, right? So the rabbis concretize it, fine, whatever. Goes on to it. All right. You shall keep this law, right, at its set time, like all the time. And when Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, as God swore to your ancestors and has given it to you, you shall set apart for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh every first issue of the womb. Every male firstling that your cattle shall drop shall be Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh's. But every firstling ass you shall redeem with a sheep. If you do not redeem it, you must break its neck. And you must redeem every male firstborn among your children. This is where we get the ceremony of Pidyon HaBen, right? The redemption of the firstborn. And when in time to come, a child of yours asks you saying, what does this mean? You shall reply, it was with a mighty hand that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh brought us out of Egypt from the house of bondage. When Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh slew every male firstborn in the land of Egypt, the firstborn of both human and beast. Therefore, I sacrifice to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh every first male issue of the womb, but redeem every male firstborn among my children. And so it shall be a sign upon your hand and a symbol on your forehead that with a mighty hand, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh freed us from Egypt. All right. We're just going to go two more verses. So verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although it was nearer. For God said, the people may have a change of heart when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people round about by way of the wilderness at the Sea of Reeds. Now the Israelites went up, what does it say here? Armed out of the land of Egypt. This is the verse we're going to look at. Verse 18. Vayasev Elohim et ha'am derech hamidbar. Yam Suf. So God takes them circuitously by the way of the wilderness at the Sea of Reeds. That, and then there's like a break in that. That's one thought. Here comes the next thought with this vav. And they went up Hamushim. What is Hamushim? So of course, if you're playing in the playground of Safaria, you can easily go over to commentary, right? You can highlight the verse and go over to commentary, right? And see, what might that mean? This word Hamushim. And Safaria tells us, Rashi says, because Rashi's always going to give us the plain sense of the word, right? A Hamushim. The word Hamushim provided with weapons. This is from Mechilta to Rabbi Ishmael. Because God leads them by a circuitous route, right? That's inhabited. Then you've got to go up. You've got to go up armed, right? And so he brings us from Aramaic and other places where we see armed.
Okay.
But there seems to be some other explanations. So at the end of Rashi, he tells us another explanation of Hamushim. Notice how it's spelled in Torah. Notice that Hamushim in verse 18 is written without a letter that we pronounce. What's the letter that's missing? Here's the word Hamushim. Huh? The Vav. Very good. Star goes to Margo. The Vav is missing. But we pronounce it Hamushim. In the Torah, there are no vowels. So we don't have that three diagonal dot vowel to tell us it's U. So what could you read? If you don't have an U there, what could you read? Something about like Hamashim.
Something about five.
Something about five. Hamashim is 50. So, all right. So if what is the point of that? What Rashi's saying is, we read it Hamushim, but it's spelled and written in Torah without a vav, which means you could pronounce it Hamashim, Hamishim, something about Hamish. Okay. So Rashi gives a nod to that here at the end of his commentary on this verse, but we have it on our sheet. So let's just go to our sheet. All right. Rashi, Hamishim. Another explanation of Hamishim is only one out of five went forth from Egypt. And four parts of the people died during the 3 days of darkness because they were unworthy of being redeemed, delivered.
Huh.
This is based on Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael. If we look at Rabbeinu Bachya, Rabbeinu Bachya brings a midrashic approach from Tanhuma. The word chamushim means one out of five. Four-fifths of the Jewish people died during the plague of darkness. So as not to give the, why did it happen during the plague of darkness? So as not to give the Egyptians the satisfaction of knowing that these Israelites had not been found worthy of redemption. Some say that the word chamushim refers to one in 50 Israelites only being redeemed. Some even claim that only one out of 500 Israelites was found to be worthy of redemption. All right, so this is what Rav Avi starts her lecture with, the Mechilta that we just saw. The piece from Tanhuma. One out of five turns out to be the most conservative estimate. One-fifth, 20% of the Israelites went out from Egypt. Other explanations say one out of 50. Some say one out of 500. So what does that mean about the night that we just read, the night of the first Seder? Not that there was a Seder. The night of the eating of the Paschal Lamb and Matzah. Tell me now more about that night. If this is, let's just go into this imagination for a minute.
It's everybody.
Almost everybody died. So the people who are eating, talk to me about them. Talk to me about that dinner. Talk to me about that night. It is not a happy time. They've just, if it happens during the plague of darkness, then that was yesterday, right? What's happening in the Egyptian houses?
Firstborn
is dead in every Egyptian household. So there is wailing and crying and screaming and mourning in every Egyptian household. Now, if we take this midrash seriously, then what's happening for the people sitting at the table eating that Paschal lamb with their loins girded, ready to go to freedom? They are mourning their dead. Every house, 80% of every household died from the Hebrews. That's how they're eating the Paschal lamb. And that's how they're going out into freedom. So Rav Avi says, imagine you're one of the 20%. Are you ready to follow this God? Are you ready to go with this guy and follow Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, who's responsible
for the deaths
of 80% of your people who are not fit to be redeemed? Would you trust, forget being angry at that God. Rav Avi doesn't even go that far. Would you have faith that you would be protected? Would you have faith if you're cast your lot with this God that you're going to leave and the Egyptians aren't going to do anything to you? They who have a dead person in every single household?
They really had no choice.
So Alex says they have no choice.
What choice do they really have? Are you going to step in the status quo?
Ah, okay. So Alex hits on the exact place where we're going to go. Do you stay with the status quo? If the alternative is terrifying enough, the answer is yes. You stay with the status quo. But, however, lots of people stay with the status quo because it's more comfortable. They're scared for lots of reasons and feel like staying is not as dangerous as leaving into an unknown.
The evil you know.
The argument that somebody could have made stay is, well, Pharaoh said we were too numerous. We're not too numerous now. And as a matter
Good.
Of fact, more Egyptians got spared than Hebrews.
Good. Richard went very quickly to, we can turn this. We can spin this, people. Like, we're 20% of who we were. Pharaoh has no reason to kill us now. We're not a threat. Why not stay? You trust that situation? Really? And where are we going again? Anybody have the map? Did anybody here get a copy of the map?
No one.
Yes.
Has anybody seen the map? Has anybody heard that anybody has seen the map?
But that's what faith is ultimately all
about. Says Alex, that is what faith
necessarily in.
Is all about. I recommend Rabbi Avi's Strasberg. I want to say Strasberg. I'm probably getting her name wrong. I recommend her lecture. Because that's when she says we are children of believers. And then she talks about faith. And what does faith look like for that first, you know, what does it look like as you come down through the generations? And so it's a fascinating lecture, but we're going to go a slightly different direction. So faith. So status quo, what's comfortable, what's riskier, what if we can spin this? What if we can spin this? And that's the narrative we can tell to ourselves and to our enemies. And then faith in what?
The community, in the people.
That what? That faith in the community that what?
They have to have faith in the community or was it Moses or ultimately in the unknown because.
That the unknown will be what?
Better than.
Ha. Ha. We have to be specific. Can't you say faith, right? Faith that. The unknown.
The metaphor for everything. It's, you know, it's like.
Well, that we're not like that.
Start. We're the same.
All right. So faith that whatever we don't know that is so scary is better than if we stay here, right?
One would argue those of us who, and you know, have lived know that anytime I have to speak, I can only speak for myself, but that anytime I stay in a place of comfort, though I know that's not the right choice, ultimately you're just stuck. And then we can look at throughout history if you want to look at, you know, the common theme of the Jews when you stay somewhere that's comfortable, ultimately, you know, because of fear, then ultimately we're killed or persecuted anyway. So,
or we can look at the golden age of Spain, where in Italy, people stayed and they had a great life. Yeah. Dona Grazia from the House of Nazi had a beautiful life.
Nazi Germany and all the.
But you're telling the story from knowing already they're going to die, whereas not everybody did. If you're telling the story about the people who died, sure, we can make that case, but not everybody did. You don't know. That's the point of faith, is you don't know. You trust either I'm going to be safe. It's going to be okay. We can spin this. It's going to be all right. It's like the situation's changed. We're only a 20th of what we used to be. The situation's changed. Certainly Pharaoh will see that, right? They need us here, right? So you have faith either in that or you have faith. No, it's going to be terrible for us to stay. We're in too much danger. They could turn on us at any time. Or what about everybody else who is, frankly, I believe most of us are usually somewhere in between. We're all somewhere in between, right? Like when people say, okay, next election, you know, if it doesn't go this way, you know, we're moving to, I'm like, okay, stop, just stop. I have no tolerance for it anymore. Just stop. You're not moving anywhere. If so, show me your plans. Show me the city in Portugal you're going to. Like, stop with it already. You're not going anywhere. So why do you do that? It makes me crazy now. Because why do I get crazy? Because it's like, you're not leaving. There's nowhere for you to go. Where are you going to go? Canada? They don't want you. Good luck getting, you know, a passport. They don't want us. Because if things go badly, we brought it on ourselves, right? We're such idiots. They don't want us there, tanking their system. Where are you going to go? So, no, face it. You're going to stay here and fight. However, whatever that looks like to you, you know, or you go underground for 4 years and hope it all passes, right? So, but we're a lot of us stuck in this middle of what we're going to do. All right. So let's look at what our tradition has done with some of this and where our modern commentator is going to go. All right, Sforno says, "V'chamushim alu." They went out chamushim. Although they had left Egypt fully armed, they did not have the courage to face the Egyptians in combat. In spite of their being armed, they felt too inexperienced to face trained warriors. So Sforno saying, this is why God, even if they went up armed, God has to take them a circuitous route because they're going to chicken out, right, about actually fighting because they're not used to fighting and they're unsure. Like even though they have the weapons, they won't know how to use them and they're going to chicken out. And so God has to take them a different way. All right. Let's look at Dana Kaplan from a piece from the Times of Israel. Why did so many Israelites refuse to leave Egypt? The Mechilta of Rabbi Ishmael plays around with the letters of the word armed, chamushim, to suggest that if the vowels were altered slightly, it might actually mean that only one out of five, Hamisha, Israelites left Egypt. Then we get, right, we've seen the 50, 500. The others apparently refused to go. Now, so there's a machloket. There's different opinions. Some say those 80% died during the plague of darkness, but that's not everybody. Some say they didn't go out. Only one in 50, one in 500, one in five, whatever went out. The others refused to leave. Some state that they may have been put to death by God under cover of darkness, or the Egyptians would not see and erroneously come to believe that God had turned against God's people. On the other hand, some Egyptians came with the Israelites out of Egypt. They were part of what was called the mixed multitude in the Torah, right? The Erev Rav. Also, many scholars believe that only a small number of Israelites actually came out of Egypt, and most of what became the Jewish people never left Canaan. But those are topics for another day. He sounds like me. If so many Israelites refused to leave Egypt, why? Of course, I do not know for sure. I was not there. But I can speculate. In one word, fear. They feared the unknown. Who could blame them? What is amazing is that a minority dared to dream of the possible, no matter how improbable. Rabbi Jonathan Tawil says, Rashi in Pesichta Derav Kahana explained that the word v'chamushim is spelled without a vav, right? This leaves it open to be read as chomesh, which means one-fifth. Blah, blah, blah. We've seen this a lot of times. Now, the majority refused to leave and thus perished during the plague of darkness so that the Egyptians would not witness their deaths. They were so assimilated, they had gotten used to the Egyptian lifestyle. Why should they leave? To Richard's point, we can spin this. On the contrary, now that they were free, they wished to stay and live in Egypt as free citizens. They felt there was no need to make an effort to go through the wilderness on a long trek to fight a war with the seven nations in Israel and conquer a land they knew little about. Dan Schnorr, from the professor at the University of California, Berkeley, USC and Pepperdine, from the Jewish Journal, the Israelites who stayed behind. But what about the Jews who weren't brave enough to leave, who didn't have the mettle or the audacity to abandon their homes in Egypt? We like to think of the Jewish people as a unified and presumably unanimous collective who together possessed the valor and character to take control of their destinies, Alex. The fact that most of them lacked the necessary conviction to stand up for themselves is not the type of uplifting story that fits neatly into the biblical narrative. But that actually makes the actions of the 20% who did follow Moses even more admirable. Recognizing that such heroism was not automatically distributed to an entire population, but rather reflected the more unique qualities of a smaller number of Abraham's and Sarah's descendants, can be very valuable to us today as we consider how to confront our current challenges. We live in a world in which we are surrounded by rising levels of anti-Semitism and see a puzzling level of apathy toward this threat from many of our fellow Jews. This was not written this year. Right? This lesson from ancient Egypt should remind us not to be surprised that many 21st century Jews have decided that the potential difficulties that come up with confrontation are not worth the disruption to their otherwise comfortable lives. But if it only took a small percentage of the Israelites in Egypt to risk an imperfect but tolerable existence to regain our promised land, then a comparably small minority of today's Jewish community will surely be more than sufficient to lead the effort to push back against a much less powerful group of modern day haters. Instead of waiting for those in our community who are not willing to push back against bigotry, better to move forward without them. Instead of wondering why so many others are willing to suffer in silence, the rest of us have work to do. So this piece about, right, written years ago, about rising anti-Semitism and folks who were like, you know, not myself included. I was like, I'm not going to get all crazy about this, right? Those of us who believe in American exceptionalism, who believe it's different for the Jews here, call us folks who lived in Nazi Germany and didn't leave. We believe in American exceptionalism. I'm like, we don't have to get crazy about this. Yes, it's there. We know it's there. It's always been there. It's always going to be there. But our lives are, if we look at our lives overall, our lives are pretty good in America, right? The Jews have it pretty good. So this conversation is not a new conversation, right? Nazi Germany is what we keep bringing up because it's what we remember in our lifetime. You know, that they were comfortable. They thought it could never happen there. And look what happened, right? So you got those folks that you're an idiot if you stay. Then you have those of us who say, I am not going to react to Nazi Germany as history, as the only case in history. There's also ways Jews have been in places that were exceptional and they had really wonderful, amazing communities and wonderful lives. So we need to hold everything in perspective. Elena?
We're just thinking of the similarity of the turn of the century when so many Jews came from the Russian area, which people chose them, which people stayed behind.
Right. Right. So the conversations in every household, who do we send?
And what are the kinds of people who choose to leave?
Right. And when? Who are the people that leave early on? Who are the people that leave when, okay, you know what, it's gotten too hot? And who are the people who stay?
All of us, and one of our ancestors.
Somebody left. We are all here because somebody left. Absolutely. We stand as one of the descendants of the 20%. For sure.
They left for very different reasons, very often from the different countries.
They left for very different reasons. Some people left because of poverty and there was no opportunity. Poverty and there was no opportunity because they were Jews. Some of us are born into non-Jewish families and wind up with the Jewish people, right? Go figure. Right? So there's lots of ways we get here, but we are all descendants of people left. And if we're in America, all of us are descendants. I don't care if you were born to the Jewish people or not. All of us are descendants of people who left. Unless you are, go define the word indigenous, because there's a whole, go read Yuval Harari on Sapiens, and indigeneity becomes a much more murky term than we are willing to deal with. But so
all right, let's go for it.
Yeah, Margo's like, okay, yeah, tell me more about that indigeneity, right? So unless you're Indian, all of us, and some people would argue they are not the first peoples who lived here, we all are descendants of people who left, right? So we get that. All right. So what if we put it in context, and this is the article that Don, who I love, sent to me. What if we really put it in the context of right now? And I'm not talking about citizenship and leaving this country. I'm not talking about that. What if we put it in the context of right now, looking at our comfort and how many of us are ready and willing to truly figure out what's needed in this moment, in this country, to turn, and I'm not just talking about anti-Semitism, to turn the ways that there is a monolithic push on the right, on the left, and now even center left, there's this monolithic push that drags everybody along with it because we don't stop to question and we don't want to disrupt. And we just want to kind of go with what we're told is the agencies, the organizations, the movements that we can trust or that we have allied ourselves with. And who of us is ready to really leave the comfort of that to be a disruptor? And isn't that what this country is going to need? So that's the article. That's the framing of the article that now we're going to take a look at. I did not print it. I will be happy to send the link. Bert always posts the link. I'm going to have it on the screen. And we're just going to, it's long. So I didn't do too much text because it's long and we're not going to go through the whole thing, but I just want to look at chunks of it. Now, to be fair, I don't go as far as the author goes. I had to do some other research on her. She's the editor of Tablet Magazine, Elena Newhouse. I don't know enough about her and her politics to know what she said. She goes too far for me. Let's just put it that way in this article. She goes too far. She makes it sound like there's some kind of grand,
conspiracy?
Yes. It's a conspiracy. It's kind of a conspiracy theory. That's my language. That's my words. It's just from a couple of readings of the piece. I read another piece of hers that explicates her thinking a lot more clearly. And then I was more comfortable with some of the language she uses in this article.
Was the article in Tablet Magazine? Is that where you?
It was in, no. Was it? Robin, was it in, Tablet, or it was in another source where we got it, right? Let's see if it's on here.
It's an all, it's
a, so yeah, so I guess it is in tablets.
It's a Jewish magazine.
It's a Jewish magazine. And she's the editor of this online.
It's online only.
Jews and the world, you know, it's.
Right. The articles are very long.
They're very long. It's a very long essay. It's a statement piece, you know, about where we are. This is not just an article on this week's Torah portion. All right. So the Jews who didn't leave Egypt, a lesson from the past about choosing freedom over servitude. All right. She goes into this whole Hamushim thing, which is when I'm like, okay, this is the third time I've come across this. Now it's being sent to me by a congregant. Clearly I'm called into this. So I'm like, I'm going to slog through this article. All right. So she talks about Hamushim. She explains how we get, you know, this term and what it means. And she says, I've been thinking a lot about these Jews lately. I think about them when people refuse to accept that beloved blue chip organizations, the ACLU, the ADL, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, no longer fight for their own founding values. I think about them when I talk to people who straight-facedly cite the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, or other formerly great outlets as authoritative sources of news. I think about them when I meet people who can't imagine, literally cannot make their brains consider their child or mine not going to a prestigious American college or university. Then she goes into things like, right, Ukrainian flags go up, right? And, you know, Jews start posting about right away about hashtag Me Too, hashtag Time's Up, BLM, all that stuff, the trans movement. I think about these people, and she calls this essentially a collectivist swarm. I think about these people, about the moral imagination needed to take risks, to leave old worlds and build new ones, about the confidence required to believe that it is you who makes a given institution or cause or idea legitimate and special and not the other way around. About the bravery and faith needed to withstand the loneliness of the desert of outsiderness before getting to the Israel of a new life. I think about all of this and suddenly Rashi's insight becomes less mysterious, meaning that some weren't worthy of being redeemed because they weren't gonna risk it, right? They wanted to stay. So then lots of stuff about Black Lives Matter, and how, right, that organization, lots of stuff was disclosed about that organization, the Women's March. She talks about the Women's March and then how that kind of imploded and collapsed, that the organization that, arranged it because of all kinds of stuff that was going on that you didn't dare question. Originally, right? You didn't dare question Black Lives Matter or you were racist. You didn't dare question the Women's March because then you're not a feminist.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of us were stuck in that particular trap.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of us stood up for the cause of Black Lives Matter originally and then started to have some apprehension, right? About, whoa, is there anti-Semitism here? Is there anti-Zionism here? Right. So, but the discomfort of standing up and questioning. Because that's what you're supposed to support, right? Right. So in an age of uncertainty, it feels good to cast the habit of questioning aside and embrace the idea that the cautious weighing of evidence is unnecessary. Your side walks in light. The other side dwells in darkness. And indeed, there is nothing wrong with fighting racism wherever you find it. Fighting for equal rights for people of any gender, orientation, or sexual preference is good. Promoting public policies that bring safety and security and clean air and clean water and needed medicine and economic opportunity to more people is a noble aim. Protecting the environment is also good. There's nothing wrong with opposing Vladimir Putin's brutal invasion of Ukraine. But, right, B-U-T, the public campaigns that utilize these virtuous slogans on social media are political tools wielded by people who are interested in corralling the public toward a variety, she claims, of unrelated ends, including their own self-enrichment. Ask yourself how all channels of discourse in America suddenly flow in the same direction, making local and institutional and communal distinctions that were once defining seem vanishingly trivial. So the things that made local, institutional, and communal distinctions important are vanishing. And we are becoming monolithic. So the flavor of a certain local newspaper versus now we all, you know, get our, you know, thing from here's the digest from the New York Times for today on your phone that you look at before your feet even hit the floor. Right. So that we're losing the local, institutional, and communal distinctions that allowed for a plurality of viewpoints and ideas and ways of looking at things that made for a discussion and a conversation and a debate and an argument. Like you said, we can't talk to each other. That I don't think she's wrong about.
Nuance.
The lack of nuance, the lack of, okay, so in our community, we have a history of blah, blah. So we tend to see it a little bit differently. But then you meet somebody from another community. Okay, so talk to me about like what, right? But we're losing all of that, of news deserts,
right?
And she calls it flatness, like that we're flattening. And then she has a whole piece on flatness, which I'm going to read next.
Isn't this also part of that whole concept of intersectionality, you know?
It's a huge conversation about that, right? The people who control the key platforms and networks, and that means on the left as well, by the way.
Yeah.
Right? She's not talking about so much the right.
Yeah.
The people who control the key platforms and networks are aggregating power to themselves at the expense of everyone else. These people and the institutions they dominate are not interested in social justice or any other kind of justice, except to the extent that they can be used as shields. This is where I'm like, okay, it's going a bit down a rabbit hole that I'm uncomfortable with, but I'm okay being uncomfortable, which is why I brought it. Like, I just think to her point, maybe I need to be a little uncomfortable and figure out what that means. Why? Why am I so uncomfortable? Right? You know? Okay. She says, different people have different words for this new monolithic reality, but everyone who isn't either naive or craven knows that it exists. I envision it as a pyramid, one that contains the sum total of every slogan and brand name and source of prestige, acting and speaking in unison. To live in its shadow, to take one's moral or political or social cues from the pyramid's overseers, meaning we can't question, we can't ask, we can't have another way of looking at it, we can't have our own local experiences, we get right, you have to go along with the, you know, slogan that are in the hands of the overseers. Those slogans are right in the hands of the overseers. It's not simply an act of idol worship, it's a form of servitude. For American Jews, our addiction to being insiders is especially dangerous at this moment because it means siding with people who don't like Jews very much. And in some cases, actively wish us harm. So if we're going to stay on the inside, then want to stay on the inside of feminism and the lesbian, not that I'm relevant to the LGBTQIA community because I'm just an L and I have nothing to say. I'm completely irrelevant because I'm just an L. We're told now we're not even queer. And lesbian is exclusionary. It's an exclusionary term. Right. So I'm not even relevant to the LGBTQIA community. So forget that. But let's just say feminist, right? You know, if you want to stay relevant and you're going to stay an insider, then you have to march with people who make you choose between being Jewish and being female, right? All right. Or fill in whatever insiderness you want to talk about. You want to go to an elite university? Okay. Well, then you have to, right, get with folks who have been taught in such a way that it's now exploding. Right? Okay.
And you have to suppress your Judaism.
And you have to suppress whatever part of your being Jewish doesn't fall in line
with them. Yeah.
So it means siding with people who don't like Jews very much and in some cases actively wish us harm. But it's more than that for everyone. When status becomes the reward for serving those in power, who in turn reduce the rest of the population to forms of abject powerlessness, then seeking it out becomes toxic. And it's not simply that we shouldn't be participating in this system. It's that we, especially those of us who care about the less fortunate, who want to see more justice in the world, who want more safety and health and prosperity for greater numbers of people, should be leading the charge out of this Egypt, helping to build the institutions and communities and companies and cultural organizations of a new and better future. Because if there is the pyramid, there is also a space emerging outside of it. A space increasingly populated by people who want to take back their right to question, who want to experiment and quarrel and even get things wrong sometimes, but to do so according to their own consciences and who are willing to sacrifice comfort and prestige for that freedom. And like all I can think in my head, which keeps screaming is, am I? The people who dwell here are not part of any political faction or ideological school, or rather, they are from all of them. Indeed, the operative distinction in the near term in American politics will not be between left and right, but between insider and outsider, between those incapable of leaving their flesh pots and those who would willingly face uncertainty and risk for the chance at a better world, between the majority that stays and is swallowed up by history and the minority that leaves and makes the future. Wow. Whoa, whoa, whoa. And it put it in a whole new light for me about, it isn't about literally leaving. We're not leaving. Are we willing to leave our status as insiders to challenge the norms that we're now being told you have to fall in line with, or you're not for social justice, right? You don't care about Black people. You're racist if you don't support the movement BLM. Forget the cause, the movement. If you don't support the Women's March, you can't possibly be a feminist. You don't care about women's rights if you don't support the organization that put together that march.
And when you start questioning that, then you get accused of being on the right, of like a right winger or something.
Correct.
But ultimately, it's also performative anyway, because it's that this day-to-day interaction. Are you really for and with Black people? Are you really for
and this rights? And she actually, day-to-day interaction. She makes that point in the article. She doesn't use the word performative, but she says, they don't help anybody anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, like this, it just makes money for the people who found the organization and then convince everybody that you have to buy in. That's who's benefiting.
What's really sad about it to me is that the underlying values that are being peddled here are actually the good Jewish values.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so seductive to these people who don't know a whole lot, but they recognize intuitively those values that they were raised with. And they're being manipulated. It's so
correct. And so that's why the piece landed for me, because it's about they're too afraid to question, because they're being told if you do, you're now disloyal to the very values that, well, you're right, that are in our kids' kishkas.
You're canceled.
You're canceled. And you're canceled by the people you want to be on the inside with, because you believe the rhetoric. Okay. You believe they stand for those things, like stand against racism, stand against a certain kinds of domination over people who don't have wealth and don't have access to wealth in this country.
Isn't it new? You know, this is like one of my grandfathers, the communist, suddenly realized that he couldn't be part of that anymore because of Stalin and because of how they turned on the Jews and Israel. Right. I mean, his whole orientation just kind of went bleh. But he changed. He left.
And it's interesting to me. That plus all the different organizations that were mentioned in the article, a lot of them have fallen under their own corruption and weight. So for me, kind of riding the wave, I'm like, let's just hold on for a second. Let's see if they screw themselves up before I have to waste any of my energy showing them how wrong and stupid they are. It's a good thing. And others don't. Others float. And sometimes you just try a little bit and meet the right people. And sometimes new things come out of things that you wouldn't even have anticipated. Sometimes things bring you together for a moment. You realize this isn't the place to make it happen. And then the next thing comes on. So I don't know. I have optimism. I'm always hoping for the best. But
So for those of us who are not optimists, this is really important, because what it's saying is it's a culture of not being able to question.
Right.
Yes.
That's what we have to challenge. And we give up insider status to be the agitator, I get what you're saying, that like no one needs to walk around going, oh my God, this is the greatest organization ever. And it's the only answer to institutional racism. I'm not suggesting any of us would do that. We're too cranky. But it's great. We're too realistic. We're too like, yeah, whatever. That's great. You do that. I'm going to work in the ways that I know. Right. So, but the fact that you can't question on the left and in these institutions that say they represent the very values that make us proud progressive Jews is where she's saying, do we have the courage to risk the comfort of that insider status? Because for a lot of people, it means jobs. It means profits. It means going to the institutions where you'll meet someone, whether it's your husband to be, you know, or it's a professor who can give you a hand up into their, you know, law firm or get you into a good law school, right? There's a lot of ways that being an insider gets you stuff that you don't have as an outsider. And when you're labeled an agitator or whatever, you know, label you want to pick that makes you canceled in the places. And I'm not talking about the far edges. Well, none of us are going to be there. We don't locate ourselves there. But she's saying, would you consider if your kid got into Columbia saying no, thank you?
Yeah.
I don't know that I would. I don't know. But I know that I'm nervous that I might not say no, right? Because I want so desperately for my kid to succeed. And we don't live in a meritocracy.
Fortunately, there are some agitators. I mean, some very wealthy philanthropists are pulling their money out of the Ivy League schools.
Right. Because there's a treatment of Jews. We're, you know, if I'm teaching my child or my students to be an agitator, aka an activist, then that's the predicament, right? Because this is what we are teaching the students, in essence, to be activists. But then what happens when the activating or the activism doesn't align with your values?
Well, that's where we are, right? That's right. That's where we are. And will we be the 20% or of the 20% who say this has to change and we have to call it out where we see it?
If you're an apostate, if you stand away from BLM or any of these organizations, where do you go?
Right.
There isn't an organization that represents what we're talking about now. So you're a bunch of individuals within the organization trying to change it, which is what Kelsey says. Change it from within the organization, well, not so easy.
Right.
So
then the question is, what do you build instead? I think is one of the questions. Right.
What
do you build instead? So that's number one. But number two, maybe we take a step back from everybody's got to support this organization because this organization is going to defeat racism in this country. How about that's one approach? How about we actually go to the people in communities that and say, how can we help? What can we do? You tell us, right? Because we don't know. Right. So not just you folks over here in this one way of expressing it, but actually become allies and start learning and getting an understanding of what we can actually do to help, right? And we, nobody wants to do that footwork. Nobody wants to have to do the research. Nobody wants to have to put their own time and energy into figuring it out. I get it. It's hard. It's a lot, right? It's overwhelming. It can be unsettling to say, I don't know, teach me, but if we don't and we just put in other organizations, like, what's to protect them?
We don't have a map.
Right.
And there's no, have we even seen anybody who has seen?
Beautiful, Richard. Beautiful.
It's like, we don't know where to start. And so why should we be the 20% who have faith that there's something out there?
Right. Beautifully said. We don't have a map.
Except I don't agree with that. Teaching today was all about art.
Right. But I think what Richard is saying when we say, okay, well, what's the alternative? Richard's right to bring it right back around to, we don't know because we don't have a map and we don't have anybody who's seen a map. We don't know. All we can do is start that.
Well, we
do. Or at least start saying out loud, like we want to question the assumptions that these things stand for our values. Do they? And when you start to question that, you take a risk. And are we ready to take the risk and sacrifice our insider comfort, right? That's all I'm asking. That's the starting point, right? Alex, what are you saying?
I have some ideas of where to start rather than, you know, put all your energy into this collective movement, right? That's mass. Mm-hmm. You start within questioning your own organizations that you're part of and addressing the inequities in those organizations and questioning and critically reflecting and saying, where are my blind spots? Where, you know,
yeah.
And then also how do we engage in true civil discourse with people that we know we don't agree with, you know, because also, you know, and it's in some sort with some civility and dignity, I think, but I don't have the map for that, but I think we do though. I think intuitively do have the map because
bingo, their faith is enough, and the opportunities will show up for you to move into the things that you should be doing to make
move. Oh, here go the optimists. Okay. Richard, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, even come here, go there, like, we all have our experience of where you're like, wow, I didn't know I was supposed to be here, and here we are. It didn't exist before, and it does. So, yes, and.
So, from the point of view, like, world building, we're constantly going at it from the point of view, like, what if? What if this? What if that? And where the faith has to be is living as if the world has already changed, and living and leaning into operating as if the world is a different place, except we don't really know how to act that way because we can't imagine the transition from the what if things were better.
And we're aware that the world isn't there and our country's not there, right? Yeah.
Now, I just wanted to add a discussion that I had with a neighbor today who is an Iranian Jew who listens to the Persian news every day.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about how he feels that Iran has been very active in also fomenting some of this negative stuff in the universities.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
And
their money's all over it, of course.
Yeah, I mean, it was very...
The funding, yeah, they're coming from Arab countries is
but especially
well Iran. Documented.
But I think that's Mark... What, how about where we start?
I think it starts what Amy taught.
Okay.
I think if you read the paper, you'll hear more than half of the people are non-students at these colleges. There was an article this morning.
Right.
And in the neighborhood around Columbia, like any other morning, it's only the reporters that are magnifying out. So they're cracked.
Thank you.
Amen.
Thank you all for your attention. And thank Don again, Robin, for sending that over.
You've been listening to Rabbi Amy Bernstein's Friday Morning Torah Study from Kehillat Israel in Pacific Palisades, California. For more information, go to our website, www.ourki.org.